Welcome to Food Psych, a podcast dedicated to critiquing diet and wellness culture and answering your questions about intuitive eating and the anti-diet approach. I'm your host, Christy Harrison, and I'm a registered dietitian, certified intuitive eating counselor, journalist, and author of the books Anti-Diet, The Wellness Trap, and the new Emotional Eating, Chronic Dieting, Binge Eating, and Body Image Workbook, which are all available wherever you get your books or at ChristyHarrison.com/books. That's ChristyHarrison.com/books. And by the way, on this show, we avoid diet culture details like weight and calorie numbers, but we don't censor swear words or other adult language, so listener discretion is advised. Hey there, welcome back to Food Psych. This episode is a Q&A I shared on my other podcast, Rethinking Wellness. It went live there months ago, and I'm excited to bring it to you here now. If you want to get my most up-to-date content, please become a paid subscriber at rethinkingwellness.substack.com. Meanwhile, I can't wait to share this Q&A with you in just a moment. Intuitive Eating Fundamentals, the online course I created to help you make peace with food, is now available as an evergreen, self-paced course with lifetime access. It teaches you how to recognize and reject diet culture, take pleasure in food and stop fighting your desires, tune back into your body's signals of hunger and fullness, end the restrict binge or restrict rebound cycle, navigate emotional eating and learn new coping skills, and most importantly, I think, avoid turning intuitive eating into a sneaky diet. Sign up now for instant access to hundreds of hours of supportive content, including 13 modules on the principles of intuitive eating, deep dives into how to handle common issues that come up when you're trying to make peace with food, special meditations, journal exercises, and more. Get all the details and sign up at ChristyHarrison.com/course or click the link in the show notes. If you've gotten something out of the conversations here, please consider supporting the podcast for a few bucks a month. The best way to do that is by signing up as a paid subscriber on Substack at rethinkingwellness.substack.com. If you do, you'll also get extended interviews and bonus segments, ad-free episodes, subscriber-only essays and Q&As, and more. Just go to rethinkingwellness.substack.com and enter your email address. And thank you so much for your support. And now, without any further ado, let's get into it. Today's Q&A is about organic foods, and there's a bonus section about special considerations for people with disordered eating. Now here's the question. What are your thoughts on buying organic food? FYI, my answers here are for educational and informational purposes only, aren't a substitute for medical or mental health advice, and don't constitute a provider-patient relationship. At the beginning of my journalism career in the early aughts, I was an organic food devotee. Several of my earliest published articles were about organic eateries and the economics of organic food, and in my personal life, I tried to buy only organic whenever possible. After reading Michael Pollan's books, I also started trying to buy local, and when I found a local product with the organic seal, it felt like hitting the jackpot. But over the years, I've come to think a lot more critically about the organic food industry, particularly when it comes to the claims about human health. Based on my reading of the evidence, I don't think we can say organic food is necessarily any better for your health, nor is conventionally grown food clearly any worse. The best available evidence is summarized in a 2025 systematic review examining the impact of organic foods on human health. It looked at 22 studies, 73% of which were observational, meaning they could only point to possible correlations or associations, aka links, not causation. Most of the studies included in this review didn't do anything to account for confounding factors, such as income, education, physical activity, etc., that could explain the correlations. But a few of the studies were different. One was a large 2022 cross-sectional and longitudinal analysis that followed 6,633 adults for 4 years. It included models that controlled for confounders, as well as models that didn't. In the unadjusted models, there were associations between organic food consumption and lower waist circumference, blood pressure and hemoglobin A1C, and higher levels of HDL or quote-unquote good cholesterol. Yet in the fully adjusted models, which controlled for many confounding variables including age, sex, race and ethnicity, socioeconomic status, education, physical activity, smoking, overall diet, and baseline health status, those associations disappeared. There was no correlation between organic food consumption and the risk of metabolic syndrome once other likely explanations were accounted for. Another paper that attempted to control for confounders was a 2021 observational study of organic food consumption and BMI conducted in a sample of 3,896 French people intended to be representative of the country's overall population. Unsurprisingly, it found that organic food consumption was higher among people with a higher socioeconomic status, a quote-unquote healthier overall diet, and higher levels of physical activity. It also included models adjusted for those confounding variables, and it found that even with these adjustments, greater consumption of organic food was still associated with a slightly lower BMI and lower percentage of people in the quote-unquote obese category. Yet in most cases, these correlations became less statistically significant, meaning the p-values increased, when those variables were controlled for. This suggests that there may be some residual confounding at play, either because the researchers didn't accurately measure the known confounders, or because others remained unmeasured and uncontrolled. For one thing, this study didn't measure or control for some of the key confounding variables that the previously mentioned study did, including race and ethnicity, smoking status, and health at baseline, which are all independently linked to weight and BMI in ways that have nothing to do with organic food consumption. The researchers also acknowledged that the effect sizes of these associations were quote-unquote systematically low in both the raw data and the adjusted models. In other words, organic food consumption wasn't linked to big changes in weight, no matter what was being controlled for. There were a few interventional studies included in the systematic review, but for the most part, they didn't find any impact of organic food on relevant health-related measures either. A small 2013 study from Denmark looked at the effect of organic food consumption on the intake and absorption of zinc and copper, two minerals that are important for health and may be affected by different agricultural practices. And they did this comparison in young men. In two double-blind trials where participants served as their own controls, the men alternated between being on a strictly controlled organic diet for 12 days and a quote-unquote washout period of at least 2 weeks where they ate conventionally grown food. There was no difference in intake or absorption of these two minerals between the conventional and organic diets. Similarly, a 2011 study by some of the same researchers involved two small double-blind self-comparison trials looking at the intake and blood levels of carotenoids, plant-based compounds that may be associated with health benefits, among men consuming organic versus conventional food. It also found no significant differences between the two groups in plasma carotenoid levels or between the carotenoid levels in plants produced using organic and conventional agriculture. On the other hand, the 2025 systematic review says that organic food consumption can reduce exposure to certain pesticides in a way that's quote-unquote indisputable, given that some of the evidence comes from experimental studies. Quote, "This finding is important for human health because of the growing scientific evidence of the negative effects of long-term dietary or occupational exposure to pesticides," the researchers write. But digging into that experimental data paints a more nuanced picture. Importantly, only two of those studies were randomized controlled trials, the only study design that can potentially tell us about causation. One was a 2019 trial in 20 low-income pregnant women in Idaho, where half of the participants were randomized to receive organic produce for 24 weeks, and the other half stuck with their usual conventional produce. At the end of the study, women in the conventional group had significantly higher levels of a nonspecific biomarker of one type of pesticide called pyrethroids, though there was no significant difference in levels of two other pyrethroid biomarkers or in any of the four biomarkers used to measure exposure to organophosphate pesticides, which are thought to have greater potential for toxicity than pyrethroid pesticides. These fairly underwhelming results were touted as showing the quote-unquote indisputable benefits of eating organic produce, but looking at this data shows that the reality is much more nuanced. The other RCT in the review was a 2022 trial in 27 adult students on an agricultural study abroad program in Greece. Researchers randomly assigned 14 participants to consume a Mediterranean diet made up of entirely conventional foods, and 13 students to eat the same diet of all organic foods, both for just 2 weeks. Before and after the intervention period, both groups ate quote-unquote habitual Western diets of conventional foods. The researchers found that participants' overall pesticide consumption went up when they switched to the conventional Mediterranean diet, whereas it went down when they went on the organic Mediterranean diet, though for certain types of pesticides, there were no significant changes. The study makes some specific claims about pesticide reduction that sound really favorable, but it's important to know that the senior researcher in this study discloses some conflicts of interest that signal a significant investment in organic agriculture. He owns an organic farm in Greece and is a member of the UK Soil Association, an organic advocacy group. As of this writing, he's currently a scientific advisor to the Organic Center, which is the research arm of the industry group, the Organic Trade Association, as well as being the director of a Center for Organics Research at Southern Cross University in Australia. So this is clearly someone who is cozy with the organics industry and a part of it himself as an organic farmer, and maybe not the most unbiased source of research on the purported health benefits of organic food. Note that none of the other studies discussed here report any conflicts of interest, and I don't have any related conflicts myself for that matter. It's also important to understand that pesticide levels in food are generally well regulated and not high to begin with. For example, in 2021, the USDA analyzed 10,127 food samples from 9 different states and found that more than 99% of these products had pesticide residues well below the EPA's tolerance levels, which are already very conservatively set at only 1/100th of the maximum exposure level in animals. So it's unclear whether efforts to further reduce pesticide exposure through organic food consumption are productive or necessary, really, even if organics really did reduce that exposure in a meaningful way, which I'm not sure they do, judging by the data we already discussed. The authors of the 2025 systematic review do acknowledge that the included studies were so heterogeneous in terms of organic farming practices, population demographics, and methods of dietary assessment that they weren't able to perform a meta-analysis. All the data was just too disparate. They caution that, quote, although there is some evidence from observational experimental studies for the superiority of an organic-based diet, end quote, which I think is overstating the case, quote, the limited number of studies, the design, and the inconsistencies between studies make it difficult to draw definitive conclusions, end quote. They call for further research and also raise the important point that there are real concerns about the capacity of organic farming to feed the world. Quote, before proposing the implementation of organic farming on a large scale, other factors besides health aspects, such as food security, food safety, environmental, economic, and social factors, should be considered, they conclude. When it comes to impacts on the environment, organic food may have some advantages, but it also may have some drawbacks. Yes, organic agriculture uses fewer pesticides, which may help reduce environmental pollution and support biodiversity. And of course, I get that that is a noble goal, and a lot of people might want to support that system by buying organic. But organic farming also produces significantly lower yields than conventional agriculture. So farmers need to use more land to meet consumer demand, resulting in higher greenhouse gas emissions in some cases. And several studies have found this. And so there's an ongoing and very polarized debate in the scientific community right now as to whether organic farming is really a net positive for the environment at all. Given all this, it's questionable whether the purported upsides of organic food really justify the additional cost. When it comes to human health, I don't think they do. Even if you want to buy organic foods for their potential benefits to the environment, which might feel more justified depending on where you stand in the scientific debate over environmental impacts, it's worth proceeding with caution if you have any issues in your relationship with food. Especially if you have a history of eating disorders or chronic dieting, frequently purchasing organic foods could pose some challenges to your recovery. Here are some important things to consider if you're working to heal from disordered eating. The first thing is that higher organic food consumption may be linked to disordered eating. Some research suggests that consumers of organic food are more likely to have orthorexia, a type of disordered eating characterized by obsession with the healthfulness and purity of food, even if they choose organics partly for environmental reasons. A 2024 study surveyed 887 young adults in Turkey and found that participants who consumed more organic food and had a greater awareness of environmental issues scored higher on a measure of orthorexic tendencies than people who ate less organic food. Of course, this is observational evidence, so it can't tell us anything about causation, right? We don't know if organic consumption and eco-consciousness cause orthorexic behaviors, or if it's simply that people who already have orthorexic tendencies are more likely to choose organic and cite environmental motivations. But there's clearly some relationship there, as several other studies have noted. A 2021 survey of 240 shoppers in Italy found that organic food store customers were more likely to report orthorexia symptoms compared to shoppers at non-organic grocery stores. And a 2016 study of 284 U.S. adults found that those who are more engaged in the quote-unquote alternative food network, which entails buying organic, local or regional, and sustainably grown or artisanal foods, were more likely to report orthorexia symptoms, though they didn't tend to engage in other disordered eating behaviors. Again, this was observational research, so we can't infer anything about causation, but it is interesting that there seems to be some connection there. All three studies also measured orthorexia symptoms with a questionnaire called the Orto-15, or a translated and modified version in the Turkish study. And the Orto-15 is widely used in research, but has been described as a mediocre screening tool because it lacks the specificity needed to accurately distinguish between pathological levels of orthorexia and more normative dietary restrictions. Still, even if the questionnaire can't be used to definitively, quote-unquote, diagnose orthorexia, it does a good job of reporting on people's concerns about the healthfulness and purity of food, and organic food consumers do seem to have more of those worries. Some organic food companies also capitalize on those anxieties, highlighting the lack of quote-unquote toxins or quote-unquote nasties in their products. They might call out specific chemicals they don't use, implying that those compounds are inherently bad. Many manufacturers use moralizing terms like quote-unquote clean and quote-unquote healthy to describe their foods, which implicitly defines their competitors' products as dirty or unhealthy. Organic food markets sometimes have signage and in-store promotions that reinforce the perception that organic foods are morally better than conventional. In my research for The Wellness Trap, I even came across an organic grocery delivery service claiming that products labeled as organic in other grocery stores probably aren't, and that the only way to ensure you're getting truly organic food is to sign up for their service. To be fair, many manufacturers of wellness culture products use these tactics, not just organic food producers. But any fear-based marketing used to sell food or supplements or household products can fan the flames of orthorexic thinking. So for anyone trying to recover from orthorexia or other forms of disordered eating, it's worth considering whether the culture and rhetoric around organic food might be exacerbating your issues. If so, are there maybe steps you can take to reduce your exposure to these orthorexic messages and spaces? The other consideration for anyone with disordered eating when thinking about organic food is that flexibility with food is important for recovery. When I was first training to become an eating disorders dietitian, I sat in on a staff meeting at a well-regarded treatment center where the clinicians were discussing what to serve at the end of lunch. They wanted to add something sweet, but not a full-size dessert, which was its own separate challenge for this clientele of restrictive eaters. One of the leading ideas was to serve a few pieces of candy after the meal. As a lowly intern at the time, I rarely spoke up in meetings, but on this day, I felt compelled to chime in. "What about a piece of fruit?" I asked, confused as to why the staff had overlooked this seemingly simple and quote-unquote healthy solution. The clinicians smiled, and one of them gently explained that this end-of-lunch sweet was meant to be a challenge, something that might not feel quote-unquote safe to the clients or really to their eating disorders. Sure, there were a few people who feared even the sugar in fruit, but candy was something that could help move everyone beyond the comfort zones established by their eating disorders. And that's ultimately what they were in treatment to do, to break free from these limiting eating disorder rules. I learned a valuable lesson that day. In order to truly recover from disordered eating, people can't just stick with foods that feel safe all the time. They need to stretch and learn to be more flexible if they want to escape the tight confines of the eating disorder. Through that and many other moments in my training, I realized that I was personally still holding on to orthorexic attitudes about food, and ultimately became much more adaptable in my own eating. Now, after more than 12 years of working with clients to heal from disordered eating, I've seen the clear benefits for people who embrace flexibility in eating and open up to greater challenges with food and recovery. So, how does this all relate to organic food? Well, in this analogy, organics are kind of like the fruit I initially suggested serving with lunch. Relatively comfortable and unchallenging for most people with disordered eating. To break through orthorexic rules and become truly flexible with food, it's important to expand the menu beyond what feels safe and easy to the disordered eating mind. And for many people, that means branching out beyond organics and eating conventional produce, protein, snacks, and other foods. Granted, this might not apply to everyone. Surely there are some people in long-term recovery who can eat flexibly, but choose to eat mostly organic for environmental reasons without harming their relationship with food. But if you're in the early years of recovery from orthorexia or other forms of disordered eating, it's probably worth pushing yourself to try other foods, not to just stick with organics because they feel safe. If it feels too scary to do that on your own, an eating disorder treatment team could help. I have a list of some dietitians and therapists I've interviewed over the years that I'll put in the Substack show notes for this episode, and another database organized by region, as well as a platform for virtual eating disorder care. So the bottom line here is that when it comes to human health, a close reading of the evidence shows that organic food isn't necessarily any better than conventional. There's ongoing scientific debate about whether organic agriculture is better for the environment than conventional. So if you're convinced by the evidence in favor of organics for pesticide reduction and reducing pollutants and increasing biodiversity, and you want to buy organic for environmental reasons, but you also have disordered eating or a history of it, I think it's important to proceed with caution and to try to stay flexible in your food choices. Thanks so much to the person who asked this question, and you can ask one of your own for a chance to have it answered in an upcoming Q&A by going to christyharrison.com/questions.
If you found this podcast helpful, I'd be so grateful if you take a moment to subscribe, rate, and review it on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. You can see all the places to subscribe at christyharrison.com/subscribe. It's christyharrison.com/subscribe. If you're looking for help healing your own relationship with food, grab my free audio guide, 7 Simple Strategies for Finding Peace and Freedom with Food. Just go to christyharrison.com/strategies to get it. That's christyharrison.com/strategies. To get full show notes and a transcript of this episode, go to christyharrison.com/foodpsych. And to get the transcript, find the episode page and scroll down to the bottom to enter your email address. A big thanks to Softer Sounds for audio editing and production, and to administrative assistant Julianne Witasek for helping me out with all the moving parts that go into producing this show. Our album art was photographed by Abby Moore Photography, and the logo was designed by Melissa Alam. Our theme song was written and performed by Carolyn Pennypacker Riggs, and I'm your host and executive producer, Christy Harrison. Thanks again for listening, and until next time, stay psyched.